This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Should we be singing more in Aussie accents? It's a perennial debate, I know. But now I think our own Aussie Delta has made it a global issue. Yes, this is The Conversation Hour, and you will have woken to the news that Aussie Delta has made the granny of Eurovision. Is she even more Aussie than we thought? You've probably seen clips of this incredibly dazzling performance she did overnight, thrilling last notes. That's been replayed everywhere. But you might have missed this. Have a little listen to the start of verse two and tell me, do you hear what I hear? I think she's bringing out the strine before snapping back again. Tell me if you hear what I hear.
Call it perfect timing. I call it divine.
Perfect timing is what I heard. Did Delta just break in and then out again of strine? Was this a little Easter egg for us back home? To be clear, I am saying this with love. I'm loving Delta's performance. I'm thinking she did it for us. She's got to be professional about it. She must have chosen. Is that her breaking into an authentic voice? And should there be more of it? Tell me if you can hear what I'm hearing, or am I going mad? And how important is it to you that we even sing with strine, that we have those Aussie accents? We're going to be speaking to the great Russell Morris this hour. We'll look about why and how singers have been pressured sometimes to have or to abandon their Australian accents. I'd love to hear what you think. Jenny in Fitzroy, am I mad?
Hi, Meg.
Hi.
No, you're not mad at all.
You heard it too?
Yeah, I turned off Raph when he was talking about footy and listened to Delta because someone had spoken to Raph about how good it was.
Yeah.
And when she broke into strine, I just cracked up laughing.
Because it just comes out of nowhere. It's the beginning of the verse. And then she snapped out again.
Goes back.
Did it endear you even more to Aussie Delta, Dezza?
I'm not a fan of Delta, not a fan of Eurovision. So just watched because this woman said she cried.
Oh, yeah. We're still going to go for it. Should you do the whole final in strine, do you think, Jenny?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know. The dress was great. The hair was great. And the plinth on the piano was great.
I know. She deserves a medal for that, for getting up on that piano and then staying up there. Jenny, thank you. Thank you for calling in. Do you agree with me? And Jenny, do you hear the strine and do you like it? We're going to be talking about the history of Aussie accents in music. Also this hour, we'll be looking at what the federal budget delivered or didn't deliver when it comes to healthcare. And did Donald Trump's trip to Beijing go well? It's over now. Why is that important for Australia? We will be having a little look at that. But next, let's celebrate Delta in all her Aussie glory.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
This on text, I did hear it when I watched it. Sorry, can't hear it is another Am I Going Mad? I'm joined now by someone who knows. She's got an ear for this sort of thing. Dr. Melissa Agnew is a voice coach, speech and dialect teacher, and she joins me now. Hi, Melissa.
Hello, Mary.
For people who might have missed it, let's play that again. Let's have a little listen. I'm hearing it at the very beginning of this clip.
I call.
No, that's another bit. We'll go to the longer version. This one has the strine.
Call it perfect timing. I call it divine. So grab under your spalding, your heart to mine.
We will discuss Devon, the new word Devon. But Melissa, what do you think? Is this strine or am I going nuts?
It's beautiful Australian. I'm not a fan of the word strine.
Oh, okay.
unless it is really
broad,
intended to mock a little bit or to put down.
To be fair, I just want to make sure people know I'm using it in a very affectionate way.
Oh, good. Me too, then. I'll join okay. you, Mary. Look, pop convention, pop and rock convention is tricky for singers because there is an expectation that they do morph towards the American pronunciations with certain vowels. They seem to work better with the music demands, and certainly Delta has some huge demands, some superhuman ones in that song. Mm. But isn't it interesting that she is so authentic and reveals more of her true self and her true emotions through those Australian vowels?
So do you think she did it on purpose?
I think it was all tightly rehearsed mm-hmm. within an inch of its life. I mean, the performance is so slick.
Indeed.
I don't know. You'd have to ask her. But the interesting thing with that I sound in the perfect timing and the thing that she did in Divine in that second syllable was to me very, very interesting. It's in the vowels that you tap more into the emotional side of speech, whereas in the consonants you tap more into the sense and the meaning of speech. So the fact that she was just, when singing about such a personal and universal thing at one and the same time in another country, that she would choose and use that vowel, the broad Australian, was really interesting.
Yeah.
When she went into the divine, that vine sound in the second thing, it was actually the quality of voice that went down into her chest voice and seemed to tap into a deep, thick, spiritual thing, which was in line with the meaning.
Okay, that's something a little different. I want to dig into that. We'll replay that for people as well. But let's go to Jerry in Frankston first. What do you think about Australian accents in song, Jerry?
Oh, fantastic. I mean, Olivia Newton-John sang everything with an Australian accent and sounded brilliant. All of the time, it was such a great way to fly our flag.
That's true. It came through in some of it. It wasn't overt, was it, Jerry?
No. It wasn't like you'd say a blocker or what have you. But it was. She always had perfect diction. No, I think that it was, like I said, it was a great way to be proudly Australian without being in your face. She was definitely not an in your face type of artist.
Exactly. Makes us proud, and flying the flag at Eurovision is exactly the brief for Delta as well. Thank you, Jerry. Thank you for your thoughts. Mary in Ballarat, you're a singing teacher, is that right?
I am, yeah. I'm a singing teacher and I teach predominantly primary school kids. And what I found is that it's really hard to get them out of the American R. So in like if you're saying forever, they'd sing forever and... I'm always trying to bring them back to a neutral position in their singing. I don't mind if they sing in an Australian accent, but I don't want them to be singing in an American accent.
So why do you reckon that the kids are doing it? They're mimicking what they're hearing?
Correct, yeah. They're mostly listening to American music.
Yeah. And we will talk a little later to a researcher who has looked into this and why, for instance, that might be coming back. And it's all, of course, to do with algorithms. Mary, how do your kids respond when they're told to do that or when they're asked to do that?
Oh, they're very willing to, try it, but it's a hard habit to break is what I would say. Like, so I'll highlight it on their lyrics and say, here's your hot point, watch out.
Mary, thank you so much for calling in. Really appreciate it. We're speaking about Aussie Delta's Aussie accent, was it or wasn't it? We're speaking with Dr. Melissa Agnew, who is a voice, speech and dialect teacher and coach. Just for the people who have missed it, we're going to play that full version again that includes the strine, and then she snaps out of it, and then we'll talk about one particular word in it.
Call it perfect timing. I call it divine.
Devone. We played Devone again, Lee?
I call it Devone.
Okay, so I had to look up the lyrics, Melissa. It is divine. and I hear yes. Devone. What is yeah. happening there?
She's really applying something extra to the vowel, and also it's perhaps at the lower end, that note is down in her range. So she's got to pull out some of the big guns to be able to get there.
And that's
normal. We've got such a huge range that our voices are capable of, not just of note, but also of tone, colour and qualities and different singing styles. And clearly Delta goes right down into that chest voice there.
And let's be clear, as I said, in response to some of those texts, this isn't criticism. This is a woman who was doing something incredibly physically hard.
Wasn't she glorious?
She was. She was. Gail,
can I make a yes. comment on something that Mary from Ballarat said?
Yes.
That post-vocalic R in a word like morning, Delta doesn't sing it. So the post-vocalic R would be the thing that a lot of North Americans do where they include every R that's present in the spelling. Mm. So morning, for example, would be the American way of saying it. Consistently through the song, Delta doesn't do that post-vocalic R.
Right.
There's another bit where she sings the sky full of stars, and she does a bit of an American vowel in the word stars, but as she does in sky, but she doesn't insert the post-vocalic R.
So what it's you're saying stars. Is she's definitely on that range of Australian accented singers.
Yeah, yeah. And perhaps using what's useful to her from the American tradition to enhance or to make the most of what she does. And let's face it, most Australian many Australian professionals, who go to the United States to work professionally, be they actors, singers, other artists or other professionals, often adopt what they need to for intelligibility purposes or for cultural reasons to blend in.
And a reminder, we're going to be speaking to the iconic Australian music legend, Russell Morris, about this to see how things have changed over his time as well and what he was encouraged or maybe even told to do. This on text, she did it to pick up the Bluey votes. Very funny. Someone is saying that Devone is a Kath and Kim pronunciation. Gail, you've called in from Bendigo. What do you think about Aussie accents in song?
Look, Mary, I think one of the clearest examples is in the Waif's, one of their songs, Bridal Train, has a beautiful Missy Higgins example of that out and proud Australian pronunciation.
I think we have a bit of this. There you have it. Gail, this on text is that when people are living overseas, they love to hear the Aussie accent popping through because it grounds me to home. Is that how you feel when you listen to it, Gail?
Absolutely. And that's what, isn't that what we loved about Tim Minchin's White Wine in the Sun? That,
yeah.
That we recognise not only the spirit of the content, but that voice.
Yep, absolutely.
It can be nothing else other than Australian. Yep.
Yep, it's not just the lyrics, it's the tone and the voice as well. Thank you, Gail. Thank you for ringing in. So, Melissa Agnew, what are you going to do? Are you going to vote for Aussie Delta or tell your European friends to vote even more strongly now for the Aussie, the truly Aussie voice on the stage?
Everything Aussie. Put the Aussie voice on the global stage, I say. Where it belongs.
More oi, oi, oi in our Devoines. Melissa Agnew,
She does sing One Touch for Us. She could have done that American with One Touch for Us, but she does it with the Aussie vowel, so good on her.
Good on her. And good on you, Melissa, for joining us. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Bye-bye.
Dr. Melissa Agnew is a voice coach and dialect teacher as well. Stu from Myrna says, John Williamson, peak strine. And Graham from Geelong says, would be good if I could understand what word she's singing. I've got no idea what the song is about. Graham, go back and listen. It's good. It's good. Joining me now is Tim Kelly, who's a former label executive for Sony and who's currently program director at the Australian Institute of Music and has looked into these things. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Tell us about the history of this. It seems to be a perennial debate. Where are we at with it at the moment? There seem to be Aussie accents everywhere. I'm not sure that's the same anymore.
It's a very old debate, and I've lived in Australia for 25 years, but I'm originally from London, and, you know, it goes back to, you know, the Beatles sung with a Liverpudlian accent, where Mick Jagger really adopted the Americanization of singing for the Rolling Stones. So this goes back a long, long way. Mm. And these influences from, you know, particularly the US in a country like Australia are really powerful. And if you're an artist in Australia, this is something that you have to wrestle with. And there's a juxtaposition between the challenge that in the streaming music economy, Australia in itself is no longer a sustainable market. So it used to be that acts like, I don't know, Powderfinger or Hilltop Hoods or even Missy Higgins could make a great living just from Australia alone. That really isn't the case anymore. So developing talent in Australia has to look overseas to make a sustainable living. And the challenge there is, do you fit into those cultures where you're trying to export your music, or do you use your Australianness as your strength in approaching those cultures?
So are you saying that the Australianness is counting against them at the moment?
Well, it's a bit of both. So the great success story, one of the success stories at the moment, is a band called Amyl and the Sniffers.
Oh, indeed. And let's, for people who don't know them, let's have a little listen. For anyone who doesn't know Amyl and the Sniffers, that gives you a good idea. Tim, you were saying?
Indeed. So they lean into their Australianness, and that's what makes them attractive in other markets, because there's that differential that they add. But for a lot of people in business, and I think a lot of the record labels and the gatekeepers at different media outlets and streaming platforms, they're looking for a sound that fits into the market that you're talking about. So if someone's looking to sell music in America, a lot of the gatekeepers are looking for an American sound which will appeal to Americans rather than leaning into something different. So there's this real challenge that artists have to face between conforming to the culture that they want to enter into or holding on to their differential and expressing their Australianness to try and gain traction in that market.
That's sad, Tim, isn't it? Because so many of these texts and the calls that we're getting in is that it really speaks to something quite profound within us if we can hear ourselves in song, as Delta has done, as so many others have done. And it's sad if it's all coming down to marketing, but I'm just being naive, aren't I?
Well, yeah, it's a bit more than marketing. I think if we go back 20 or 30 years, the world wasn't as interconnected, and so regional differences were stronger. You know, accents, I think, across the world have flattened as the world has become more interconnected and people move about more, and there's more assimilation, if you like, between varying populations, whether that's on a national scale or just between two villages. And we gain something because we gain this internationalism, but we lose something as well, and we lose that distinctiveness of what we're doing. And I think a good example might be, I had a conversation with a Chilean artist who is in Melbourne recently, who is a folk artist, beautiful singer, and she was asking me whether she should sing her lyrics in English because she's now in an English-speaking market. And I was kind of saying, well, actually, the fact that you're singing in Spanish makes you different and actually makes you more special than if you were doing what you were doing in English.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us your insights into the industry and just, yeah, what we're hearing on our algorithms.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Tim Kelly, who's a former music label executive and is currently program director at the Australian Institute of Music. We're talking about Delta. We are celebrating Delta. We are celebrating her little sample quite broad little sample of Australian accent, and someone is saying it was definitely intentional, but yep, this performance was amazing. Singing with an American accent is totally unnecessary, so who cares what Americans want these days? That's from Lee as well. It is 25 minutes past 11. Keep those calls and texts coming in. As I said, later this hour, we will speak to Russell Morris about this, about what pressures he felt and whether or not they made any difference to him during his iconic time and his iconic music legend career. We are talking also, though, a little later this hour about how President Trump went in China and why it is important to us. And coming up soon, we are going to be talking about what was or wasn't delivered in the federal budget when it gets to healthcare. But to finish off, let's have a little listen to Delta finishing off in her magnificent style. That is Delta Goodrum, and we will continue to talk about that just ever so briefly with Russell Morris.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, this week's federal budget was big, of course, on the talk of tax and housing, but what about healthcare? Joining me now is Peter Braden, who is Health Program Director at the Grattan Institute. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
No problem. Good to be here.
Of course, all the talk was about property tax changes and so forth. And you have written that what was needed in healthcare, though, wasn't included in the federal budget. Take us through that.
Well, I mean, every year the budget for health goes up a lot. It just costs a lot to keep up with Australia's population as we get older and we get sicker and new technology. So there was huge new spending on public hospitals, particularly $25 billion, because there was a new deal with the federal and state governments where the federal government's going to tip in more. They added a lot of new drugs to the PBS, and they spent a lot making the urgent care centres permanent. So this was kind of a budget that a lot of it was about essentially keeping the lights on, keeping up with demand, keeping up with technology. And so there wasn't a heap of reform. Now, there were some investments in boosting vaccination for children, which has been plunging. It'd be good to see even more there, which we can talk about. And there was some investment in the health digital information system in Australia, which is really weak and fragmented, but the government's been strengthening and building up. So that was good to see. But, yeah, we didn't see the kind of big shifts in, for example, how you fund GP clinics, which we know Australia needs to make it fairer and more sustainable. We didn't see a big structural boost in the funding for prevention, where Australia lags behind most other rich countries. So it was a budget dominated by sort of keeping things going, making things permanent, rather than some of those big structural shifts we need to see in the health system.
The budget did lean into the urgent care clinics system. And you're saying that there's evidence that they can reduce the visits to emergency departments, but not necessarily evidence that the waiting times are improving. Tell us about that and whether or not this is a good investment or what you would like to see.
Well, the urgent care centres were made permanent. Previously, there've been a pilot with around 130 sites in Australia. Now, the problem is they've been made permanent before we've gotten a final evaluation. And the interim evaluation suggests they might not be getting great value for money, at least for the goal of keeping people out of the emergency department. Now, they're very popular with patients. They're delivering high-quality care. So it's sort of not surprising that this was made permanent. But the interim evaluation suggests no real effect is noticeable on emergency department waiting times. Probably there has been a reduction in the number of people that end up in the emergency department, But we only know the cost effectiveness for those patients who didn't end up going to the emergency department. So the full cost effectiveness of the whole system, including treating the vast bulk of people who might not have ended up in the emergency department, we won't know that until the end of this year. But we do know now that it's been made permanent that there need to be some improvements, you know, which include making sure we're getting the right patients in to maximise the degree to which it takes the pressure off emergency departments, and better information sharing with GPs and so on. So in a sense, you know, for a purist, this is a bit early. We haven't seen the full evaluation, but we're tipping in nearly $2 billion over 5 years. But look, they've gone ahead with it. So now the focus has to be when we get those final results. How do we make sure it's getting good value for taxpayers as well as improving the experience for patients?
You're listening to Peter Braden, who's Health Program Director at the Grattan Institute. We're talking about what is and was and wasn't in the federal budget this week when it came to healthcare. Of course, one thing that many of our listeners noted, because it is going to affect their lives, is that the government's reducing some of those generous private health rebates, more generous for older Australians. What's your analysis of the overall budgetary effect of that move?
Well, it's going to save money, so that's clear. I think that their estimate is that they will save a few hundred million dollars from this. So that's meaningful. It also aligns with their broader budget story about intergenerational equity and the current rebate here that you get for being older is being taken away, but the support for being more disadvantaged or having lower income remains. So that's kind of fits into the broader budget story. Now the question is, what will this mean for people with that cover? So it might mean some people downgrade their cover so that it, you know, is less gives them a bit less protection. But the number of people who drop cover, all the credible estimates are it'll be relatively small. And then the flow-on effect through to the public system is probably going to be smaller still. So it won't add meaningful amounts of new demand on public hospitals. But it will mean that a small number of Australians choose to leave their cover.
That's a little surprising given what we're told about the size of that cohort, that, you know, that the public system, public hospital system won't be put under more strain. Just on sheer numbers, I would have thought that there would be more of a flow on.
Well, that's because, you know, people, older people value their health insurance and they tend to keep it even if the price goes up a bit. So only a small number of people will drop that cover. And across the whole system, there's not really strong evidence that private health insurance actually takes that much demand off the public system. And when you combine that with the fact that few people, you know, many people will just choose to keep their cover, even though they have to pay a bit more, the flow-on effects for the public system we'd expect to be relatively small.
Peter Braden, also this on text. Can you ask him, where is dental? Yes, dental is still that missing jigsaw piece, isn't it?
A great point. So they did previous budgets, they've just said for the public dental clinics that are run by states and territories, we'll just roll over the funding for 1 year. There's a tiny bit of good news. They've made that funding ongoing. But your listener is right. This is one of the biggest structural problems in the health system, where we've got so many Australians saying they miss dental care because it costs too much. And almost every year, we have a record number of Australians turning up in hospital for dental problems that going to the dentist could have fixed, so having their teeth removed and other terrible outcomes. So dental was left out of Medicare from the start. There have been calls to put it into Medicare. The Greens have said we should do that. Several Labor backbenchers have said we should do it. And I think Health Minister Mark Butler has said, you know, now is not the time, but it might be a long-term aspiration. So I would love to see that that come in. We've argued for it for a long time. And if you talk about cost of living, this in health is one of the biggest pressures on households.
Peter Braden, you mentioned before that the structural change that you would like to see is about the funding of GPs. Is that the major one? Is that the one bit of reform that you think would make a real difference in people's lives?
I think that's going to be very important. We know that general practice is the cornerstone of the whole health system, but the way we fund it is really outdated. It doesn't adjust the funding for the needs of the patient, and it encourages GPs to rush through as quickly as possible, and it blocks GP clinics from employing that broader team of workers to support the GP, you know, nurses and psychologists and pharmacists and so on, who in other countries often work in these multidisciplinary teams to provide that complex and ongoing support you need as your health conditions multiply in the community and more people have complex chronic disease. So other countries have moved away from our kind of crude fee-for-service model. Mm. And there's been several reviews commissioned by the government that have said this is the path we need to go down. So I think increasingly we have to see that sort of structural reform. The government's focused a lot on bulk billing rates, dipping a lot of new money in recent budgets in to boost those rates. But we're still funding the care the wrong way, and so that will have to change.
Yeah, so one reform that they didn't quite get to. Peter Braden, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much.
Peter Braden is Health Program Director at the Grattan Institute. Dave, you've called in from Eastern Victoria. What did you want to say about it?
Yeah, it's pity Peter's not staying on the line to give an opinion on it. As we push the average life expectancy up with advanced medical treatment, I've got a query as to whether governments have worked out that if they build big new hospitals here or increase the size of the ones that we've already got, that people, you know, as the bell curve of the baby boomers dies out and the low birth rate and population decline potentially kicks in, that government have worked out that if they ride out the next 10 or 15 years of pain with ramping and hospital capacity issues, that, you know, the beds that they build now would become a bit redundant in, you know, 15 to 20 years' time.
Right, so your question, I think Peter Braden's still on the line. So your question really is, Dave, whether we should be putting more capacity in the hospitals. Is that right?
Well, I suspect government have worked out that if they do that now, and the bell curve of baby boomers dying out and population decline from low birth rates through the 80s and 90s starts to kick in. If they ride out 10 or 15 years of pain, I think there's a theory that, you know, maybe it'll get better, but I don't know that that's actually the case.
Oh, Dave, interesting theory. Peter, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. It's one I know governments are thinking about. So in the Victorian budget, which was last week, they did have a bit of money for shifting care out of hospital into the community. So continuing previous investments in home-based care and virtual care where the nurse might visit you or you're getting your care online, because they know that we can't keep building out these hospital beds. There's the longer-term thing you're talking about, Dave, of, you know, where we'll be in 10 or 20 years, but there's just the cost of building up this hospital infrastructure now, which if we keep going the way we've been going, we crowd out all the money we need to put into primary care and into prevention. So there's a big push to try and shift care out of hospitals. We did some work last year on all of the reforms needed to make hospitals more efficient, right? Again, so we don't need to keep building out all those beds. It's a problem both for the short term, which is how can we afford all of this infrastructure and all of these staff in the most costly form of healthcare. And then it's an issue for that long-term future Dave's talking about too, about, you know, do we really need these in 20 or 30 years' time?
That constant tension. Peter, thank you so much for coming back and answering Dave's question. And Dave, I hope that helps with your understanding of it as well. It sounds like it's yet to be settled. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
Peter Braden, again, from the Grattan Institute. It is 22 minutes to 11. We're talking about healthcare. We're also talking about Aussie accents. Very soon, we're going to be hearing from a music legend, Russell Morris, to talk about this. You've been texting in with all of your favourite singers who lean into the Aussie accent. I see Casey Chambers, I see Missy Higgins, and so many more. Keep those texts coming.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
My next guest needs no introduction, but I'll do it anyway. Russell Morris is joining me to talk about Aussie accents and what he has seen over his legendary career. Hi, Russell.
Hi, Mary.
Thank you for joining me. What was it like in your day when you were starting out? Was it pro-Aussie accent?
Such as people say, you've got to sing in any certain accent. I think it's due to the interpretation of the vowels in songs sometimes. And I know there are people who sing, and it's only been, well, it's Slim Dusty, you know, singing in Australian accent. So it's always been there, and I guess it's the choice of the artist. But it's, I don't know why we're in Australia obsessed with it. I don't remember anyone standing Mick Jagger up in England and saying, why aren't you singing with an English accent? Why are you singing, like if you listen to Wild Horses, it sounds like a southern drawl. Elton John, same. David Bowie couldn't have sung Let's Dance.
No, there are those particular words.
There are particular words that just do not gel and they do not sort of interpret. And I think it's great, people singing with an Australian accent. It gives a different identity. And it's all about, in music, identity. You've got to sound unique. And I really respect people who do that, you know. And but for me, I've gone in between. I've sort of... when I wrote Wings of an Eagle, the words are, well, I'm looking out on an overcast sky in the morning. I could have overcast sky in the morning.
Yeah,
it just doesn't sound right. But overcast did sound right to me. And I have done it in my songs. I've gone in between sometimes. And I understand people are talking about Delta Goodrum. And it's her interpretation. And I think she's a wonderful artist. And I really hope she does really well.
Absolutely. We all wish Delta well, and maybe even more so if she, you know, has those Aussie twangs in there, which do, as someone was saying earlier, Russell, you know, flies the flag for us, makes it, reaches out across the world to the people in Australia. We were hearing also, Russell, that these days, because of Spotify's algorithms and just the financial pressures on artists, they might actually have to choose different approaches for different markets. They can't for just to be Australian and potentially just appeal to Australians. What do you think about that, about any change in pressure because of how music is distributed at the moment, whether or not that dilutes the attractiveness, I guess, of Australians?
I don't think so. I think if the material's good enough, it doesn't matter what accent you're singing in. As long as it's something that people want to hear, and I don't think anyone should sit out there who's writing songs and go, "Oh, gee, I've got to be sound very Australian on this, you know, or I won't be accepted at home." Or gee, if I don't sound international, it's not going to be accepted overseas. I think you just do what you do. If it works, the serendipity of it is whether it works or not. It's the marbles rolling down the hill. Some of the marbles reach the bottom, some don't.
Do you remember ever thinking about this when you were performing or writing?
The only time was when my dear friend John Schumann asked me to sing on one of his records. And he got me to sing and he's going, no, mate, don't sing with an Australian accent. And I said, well, I sort of am. I am Australian. He said, no, you've got to. And he was like, he was really severe on it. And that's the only time I've ever really thought about it. I'm more interested in how the vowel sounds. Mm-hmm. If it sounds right with an Australian accent, I'll do it. But if it doesn't, I don't. I will change the vowel to make it sound right. And that's only something that's in my psyche that makes me feel, yes, that sounds right. No, that doesn't. And I can't explain that to anyone. I can't say, well, I did it because it sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, we know that you have made it work. You're listening to the great Russell Morris. We're talking about Australian accents. Russell, what are you up to at the moment?
Just writing, just doing a fair bit of writing. I'm not working anymore. I've gone off the road and that's it. So I'm just enjoying writing.
Is that for real? I mean, I know it was, this was last year, wasn't it? I think you said it was Last Chance. Really? Really? Is there anyone who can just, you know, you might be tempted back?
I'd rather tap myself on the shoulder than people tap me on the shoulder in a year's time and say, gee, he should have given up a year ago. I want to go out. I wanted to stop when I was singing at my best and performing at my best. I didn't want to be a shadow of anything. So I figured that was the best way to do it.
Yeah. Well, Russell, there's a lot of love for you here on the text line. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mary.
That's Russell Morris, Australian music legend, ARIA Hall of Fame entrant, of course, we know him, and he has been the real thing to us for so long. The real thing. We are talking real Australian voices in music. Someone says, Bluey has made the Aussie accent popular anyway. Someone's asking, where does James Rain's accent fit in? It held Australian crawl from breaking in the US. Is that right, Gary? I actually can't tell you about James Rain's accent. I've always wondered about it. And Pat says, I wish younger people would talk with an Aussie accent. So many young people these days say their vowels with a plum in their mouths. It's so irritating. Let me know your thoughts. 1300 222 774 as we continue in this conversation hour. It is 14 minutes to 12. We will talk about Aussie voices, and tell me also what you think about healthcare. Still getting some texts about that. But next, how did the US president go in China, and why does it matter to us?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, Donald Trump went to Beijing. There were big displays of flattery and warmth between the two leaders with Xi Jinping. Quite remarkable given Donald Trump's previous statements about China. What was he hoping to achieve? Did he do it, and why does it matter to us? I'm joined by Nick Bisley, who is Pro Vice Chancellor for Research and the Professor of International Relations at La Trobe Uni to tell us all about it. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you. Overall, what would you say about the success of the trip for Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's a success in the sense of, well, so far, he isn't quite finished. He's got a working lunch today and then jets back to Washington later this afternoon. But I think there's two things. One is a sort of symbolic, perhaps victory is probably a little strong, but the symbolism was very positive of a warm relationship with Xi Jinping. And he certainly made a lot of, perhaps too much, of how good their relationship was and how great a leader Xi Jinping was.
Well, he had those comments to make up for, didn't he? A quote from 2016 when he was on the campaign trail was, and apologies for, you know, these are Donald Trump's words, "We can't continue to allow China to rape our country." He said in 2020, he claimed China has ripped off the US like no one has ever done before. He vowed to make China pay in terms of tariffs. So he had, I guess, what the over-the-top nature of the warm welcome was perhaps to mitigate against the past comments?
Well, partly, but it's also he's always been one for highly personalised relationships. You know, playing a big part in his political persona, and that's across the spectrum. But in particular, he has put a strong emphasis on, you know, himself as a great leader, working with other strongmen leaders who can solve all the problems. And the language that he used was very much redolent of this, you know, when there's a crisis, you can call me and I can call you and we can get through everything. So there was an effort to present, you know, a positive, warm link between the two, which is important, I think, from an Australian point of view, for a couple of reasons. The language that you referred to earlier was, particularly in 2020, where he really went hard on China because he saw the PRC very much as the reason he lost the 2020 election. Mm. I mean, not that he admits he lost the 2020 election, but had COVID not happened, had COVID been contained and 2020 had run along the normal path, it's almost certain he would have been re-elected. And the relationship really deteriorated dramatically through that year. And many of us thought that that's what we're going to get in the second administration, a further real hardening of the relationship between these two countries. So that has not occurred is really positive to be fair.
Where does it stand at the moment? As you say, the trip isn't over yet, and you know things are always fluid when it comes to Donald Trump and his stances. But where does it stand right now?
So last year, you know, we didn't get a hardening of the military relationship, but what we got from April onwards with the, you know, so-called Liberation Day tariffs was a significant escalation of the trade war. So at one point, you know, you had 145% tariffs on Chinese goods coming into the US, which is effectively blocking them. China responded with sort of tit for tat tariffs, and in particular choked off critical minerals, which really hurts key parts of the American industry, particularly related to aircraft and car manufacturing. And so it really looked pretty bleak from a kind of trade war point of view. And then two countries realized both sides had leverage over the other. No one had a kind of decisive ability to win this contest. And so they walked things back at an APEC meeting in Busan in Korea late last year. And what I think we're going to get out of the summit is a continuation of that kind of equilibrium or that steady state that was established in Busan. So the agreement that they struck then had a 12-month period to it. So that comes to an end in a few months. And there was a lot of uncertainty was what was going to come next. And I think the big picture is the US and China are looking to stabilize their trade relationship. The fact that Trump brought a gaggle of CEOs made pretty clear that this was a trade-focused summit and also one looking at a sort of positive way of developing Chinese-US relations, not antagonistic trade wars, that sort of thing. So I think from our point of view, this is good. The US and China not fighting is a good thing.
From Australia's point of view.
From everyone's point of view. But I think also from a trade point of view, you know, we really have suffered from the significant destabilization that's occurred in the global trading regime. So anything that can take the political heat out of trade and allow market forces to work is a good thing from an Australian point of view. So net positive, although we would, I think, like to see things return much more to how they were before the trade wars began, but that's difficult to see happening.
Nick Bisley is with you. He is from La Trobe University, and we're talking about Donald Trump's trip to Beijing and why it does matter. Nick, as you say, them getting along is a good thing for everyone. It's a little awkward at the moment. Just some news overnight was that Iran allowed some Chinese vessels to pass through the Strait of Hormuz because China's government made diplomatic overtures towards them. That makes things awkward as well, doesn't it, when you've still got that stalemate there that Donald Trump has said must stay there?
Yeah, the interesting thing that came out of yesterday, so it's a two-hour meeting and each side, as always happens in these diplomatic summits, is they give a readout as to what occurred because the discussions are private. And each side provided a readout that was almost diametrically opposed from the others. There's very little overlap, which is a little peculiar. And the Americans said, we talked about the Straits of Hormuz and what China could do, and the Chinese didn't mention it at all. And so it is, notwithstanding the public pomp and circumstance and the bonhomie of the relationship, there's still these significant gaps. I do not think China's going to lift a finger on Iran and the Straits of Hormuz. They can withstand the current energy turmoil. They, frankly, quite like the fact that America's on its heels and is distracted and, to a degree, embarrassed by what's occurring in Iran. And I don't think it's in their interest in particular to change that in the short to medium term. The other big gap between the two is, of course, Taiwan. And it's interesting that yesterday Xi Jinping said, and it was reported quite widely, that he said, Taiwan is this red line issue. This has to be handled properly. If not, there will be a conflict. It's the first time you've really heard that language being sort of spoken directly to the American president in that format. Now, everyone knows that's the circumstance, but to have it called out like that was sort of notable. And leading into the summit, there had been some speculation as to whether Trump would try to essentially kind of strike some grand bargain with Beijing about Taiwan.
Yeah.
And remember, the US government had agreed to the biggest arms sales in history to Taiwan late last year. Trump then basically put that on ice. That got everyone go, maybe something is up here. But it looks like that isn't going to occur.
We will all be watching that for sure. Nick, thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure.
Nick Bisley is from La Trobe University, talking about Donald Trump's trip to China. Also this hour, we've been talking about the Aussie accent that Delta whipped out. Someone says perhaps she's considering who can vote. She's reminding UK viewers of her neighbour's heritage. Sarah in Werribee, what did you want to say about the Aussie accent?
I was living in America over 20 years ago and taking the dog for a walk. I went past a house with some guys out the front and they heard me talking to the dog and they've gone, "Hey, you're not from around here. Where are you from?" And I said, "Australia." And they said, "Can you talk like the Crocodile Man?" I said, "Mate, no one talks like the Crocodile Man."
Oh, I thought you were putting it on. I bet they thought you sounded like the Crocodile Man.
they thought that that's what I should sound like. Yeah, it was bizarre.
Sarah, thank you. Yeah, I think we've all been overseas and almost unconsciously lent into the strine. Join me next week.